And welcome back to Coast with our special guest, Dr. Mark Carlotto, as we talk about his work Before Atlantis at his website, beforeatlantis.com. You can access that through coasttocoastam.com. We're going to come back and talk more about his work and take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Dr. Mark Carlotto with us, and we'll get to your calls as well as we talk about his work Before Atlantis. Mark, by the way, where can people get your book?
It's available online at Amazon, both the hard copy and there's also Kindle edition available.
Great. And let's not let 20 years go by next time. Get you back on the show again, all right?
Sounds good to me.
Super. Now, these sites that are all over the planet, what does that tell you about the indigenous people and the brain power they had and the technology to put this together? Might it have been the same groupings of people and they scattered everywhere? Or were we having these kinds of technological advances all over the planet then by different civilizations?
I think it was a worldwide civilization. James Churchwood, in his theory of Mu, which you know he believed was Atlantis, he talks about these people that he calls the Nakal, and he had obtained knowledge of them from an Indian priest. Churchwood was a Sri Lankan tea planter, and he found out about these clay tablets. And he learned a little bit about this enigmatic civilization that existed, hundreds or thousands of years ago, that he later on found corroborating evidence of in some tablets that a mineralogist by the name of William Niven had found in the Valley of Mexico in the 1800s. And he put all this together and saw this as evidence of a worldwide civilization that existed from India to Central America and Egypt and really throughout the planet. And so what I was finding in these sites and these alignments that you know we talked about earlier was sort of correlated in many ways with what he was talking about that he had these ideas that he'd come up with. Based more on interpretation of language and symbols, iconography, which was, the method available at the time. Now, of course, we have, satellite imagery and Google Earth and aerial archaeology, and we can do, we can do other things. So, in other words, not isolated pockets of civilization, but a worldwide advanced civilization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you familiar, Mark, with some of the work of Michael Cremo?
Yes. Yeah, so he archaeology.
Yes, and he believes that mankind is way older than most scientists believe, and that would fit into some of the things that you're saying because if he's correct and you're correct, they mesh that things were happening a long, long time ago, and that we probably had the time period for this kind of advancement.
That's right, you mentioned Göbekli Tepe at the outset.
Mm-hmm.
That this has forced archaeologists to really reconsider their timetable. We emerged from the late Stone Age, 10,000 BC or so, and it was still another 6,000 years before the early civilization, the early dynastic civilizations in Egypt occurred. So with Göbekli Tepe, you're finding that happened way earlier. And so it's not one of these out-of-order discoveries that can be easily dismissed as, like with forbidden archaeology, finding a polished glass or a metal sphere in rock that's millions of years old. It's not something to be dismissed as something as simple as that or as isolated as that. But it's a large structure, and it's been dated, using radiocarbon analysis, and it clearly stands out as an anomaly against the accepted timeline. So I think these discoveries will continue to sort of push back this timeline. We're finding that that man, that hominids were out and about, you know, a million years ago, and perhaps they were quite sophisticated, you know, not too different from modern humans. And so these two were maybe beginning to converge in the process, opening up a much vaster range of human activity on the planet.
Mark, this gap between the technology that may have been here then and where we are today is huge. What do you think happened to lose it? Because it went away, and then, of course, with us, we kind of brought it back.
Well, you know, perhaps it never was lost. You know, much knowledge was preserved by Islam during the Dark Ages, right? You know, the reintroduction of a lot of ideas in Europe. So, you know, this knowledge was not lost. It was being carried on and developed in other parts of the world, and you know, perhaps this is something that's gone on for much longer. That you know, we forget where ideas get started. You know, Hancock talks about the amnesia. We've forgotten so much, and it's certainly true. Our attention spans these days are getting even shorter. But it's certainly possible that we've discovered a lot of these ideas, and they've been passed on, forgotten, and then only to be rediscovered in some other place and time. So perhaps we haven't evolved. I mean, our technology certainly, as we, perhaps we didn't have microcircuits and, cell phones back 100,000 years ago, but, our level of sophistication, was perhaps equal to, we weren't any less intelligent. It's just that the technology available perhaps was different. Maybe the ideas were expressed in megalithic structures. They were easy to build. They had the technology to do that, but didn't have the technology for cell phones. I don't know. It starts getting really speculative.
Sure.
Who knows?
Do you include the pyramids at Giza and the Sphinx in this combination of structures?
So these are the structures that John Anthony West and Schock and Bavall and Hancock. They believe these are much older. The pattern of water erosion on the Sphinx, or the pattern of erosion, which Schock believes was caused by water erosion when the Sahara was more temperate. This goes back. This pushes those timelines from the conventional Egyptian the conventional dating that exists today in the scientific community back 10,000 years ago. But because the alignment of the pyramids is to north, I believe that these were built after the last pole shift.
Aha. Okay.
The dating can be locked down, I believe, by the alignment of the pattern of the stars of Orion's belt and with the pattern of the three main pyramids in Giza. This is stuff that Bavall and Hancock and others have talked about. This way of sort of locking a pattern on the ground to a pattern of stars in the sky, I think works, and it works for that time frame, which is since the last pole shift. This is probably something that's less than 12 to 17,000 years old prior to the after the last pole shift.
Some contents things are being talked about at Antarctica, where there might be some continents underneath the ice. Now that's dramatic, isn't it?
Right, and that follows from Rand Flemath's theory that Atlantis was at a higher latitude prior to the last pole shift, and it shifted down and everything got flash frozen. I don't honestly know where that investigation stands, if they've actually or if anyone is actually actively looking or trying to excavate. But that would seem to be certainly something that could be done with current technology and probes to look begin to start looking, trying to look through the ice and seeing, you know, see what they can find.
You talk about the Nakhal. Who or what are they?
Well, if we were to try to tie it to anything, you know, within the scientific arena these days, you know, perhaps these were the Denisovans, earlier lineage of hominids that are not now extinct, but scientists are finding evidence of their genome in people in certain parts of the world. Perhaps they were them.
What might they have looked like structure-wise, height-wise? What do you think?
Well, you know, there's not a lot of information, but they found a tooth that is enormous. And, you know, it's interesting, the earliest chapters in worldwide myths, like the Aztec myth of the five suns, or Hesiod's Ages of Man, talk about the earliest ages of the planet, and even the Bible, for that matter, talks about how the
giants.
Earth was populated by giants.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Intriguing.
They might have been, and some of the renderings I've seen are very speculative, but they're quite a bit larger than modern humans. So perhaps these were the Nakhal.
Was this tooth a human tooth?
No, it was Denisovan.
Ah, all right.
And this was found in Siberia, along with a bracelet. And this is very interesting. They discovered this bracelet that was made out of chlorite, a metamorphic rock, and it was highly polished and worked. And it had a hole drilled in it that was done by a high-speed drill. In other words, it wasn't done with a simple awl. It was a high-speed drill based on the analysis. And this was up in Siberia. And you know, the assessment was, you know, this is they should not have had, they did not have this technology at the time. This is something that was dated to be about 70,000 years old, originally dated to be about 40, but then the datings were revised or extended to be more like 70,000 years ago. So you have this item of jewelry with a very precisely drilled hole 70,000 years ago. It's like, again, reminiscent of, you know, you were mentioning forbidden archaeology and those types of findings. And also, again, these megalithic structures across the world, Machu Picchu and Peru Sacred Valley and other places, you know, a 1,000-ton stone at Baalbek in Jordan, you know, what amazing technology existed at the time. You know, it even exceeds what we can imagine doing today. It's the same old story playing out, but now it's getting tied to archaeological discoveries, and so now the gap is closing. And so it may all converge to a sort of a new view of the world that our civilization is not the only civilization. It's only the most recent one.
You know, Mark, when you think back to the Star Wars movies, they had incredible technology, flying machines, yet the structures they lived in the buildings they had were all stone-type buildings. There were no huge skyscrapers or glass buildings or anything in those movies. They were all stone-type huts, much like what you're talking about.
I know.
It's fascinating. It really is. And with this, are there others who are jumping on your bandwagon and saying, you know what, he could be right?
Well, the book just came out, I've only started talking about it. In fact, I'm just giving my first public talk here in Massachusetts next week. So it's just starting to come out, and, you know, I hope, you know, I want it to be a very open process. I think this is something that can be crowdsourced. I believe there are more sites to be found.
Yeah.
And this I'm sure a lot of evidence out there from other sources that will, you know, tend to reinforce or perhaps contradict some of these findings. But, you know, this is kind of a new direction. I haven't. It's not something that I've sort of, you know, not a variation of an old theme. It's kind of a new theme. So it's a little bit out there. So it may take a little bit of time for people to kind of wrap their heads around it, because it's not, you know, people think 10,000 BC is a long time ago. I'm saying, well, it's not 10,000 we're looking at, maybe 100,000. So that kind of, I think a lot of people may have trouble wrapping their heads around that. So it may take a while for people to catch on.
Well, it's an old 4.5 billion year old planet. And, you know, chopping off 100,000 years or 200,000 years is nothing in the scheme of things, is it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Whereabouts in Massachusetts are you?
I'm north of Boston in the other Cape, we call it. It's Cape Ann, not Cape Cod. We're a smaller community, and some fascinating places up here. In fact, this is what I had been doing since between Mars and Atlantis. I was involved in learning about local history. I was spending less time in front of the computer and more time hiking and exploring the woods and getting involved with some archaeology projects that were very interesting, related to Native American ceremonial sites, and actually discovering that the Native American people 2,000 to 4,000 years ago had constructed a site using available materials, which are glacial erratics, to basically predict solstices and other celestial events. So it's, you know, this idea that, you know, they were no less intelligent than we are. Their technology that they had available to express these ideas was different, but the underlying ideas are no different from those expressed at Stonehenge or other places that came much, you know, in other parts of the world using different technology.
Well, I got to tell you, my mom was born east of you in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, and spent our summers there, Mark, and just New England is just gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's a great time. And what's next for you? We're going to take calls pretty soon, but what's next for you after this project?
Well, I'm going to stick with this project for a while.
This is going to be it for a while, huh?
In the book has gone, because this is such a it's worldwide, and there's so many different dimensions and threads in this investigation. The book kind of does a very I do go deep in a few areas, but it's very broad. And so I anticipate, in fact, I'm currently working on not revisions of the book per se, but expansions of it that I'll probably begin to publish on my blog at beforeatlantis.com. I also mentioned a technical paper that'll be coming out in the spring, and that I'll be posting that information either on the blog or I have a Before Atlantis Facebook page. So I'm going to start drilling into these different areas, these different places, and engaging with you know, local subject matter experts that know these sites. I've already started to do that a little bit, and to really try to bring this methodology into the fold, and so it, you know, get people thinking about it, and as a tool to, you know, maybe give some new fresh insights on as to these sites, and maybe someone will come up with some new idea, and it'll just, you know, another thing just to sort of you know, move things along so we can begin to learn more and try to figure all this out.
Super. We're going to come back and take the calls next with Mark Carlotto on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast on our next Coast to Coast program. The day before Thanksgiving, we're going to have our JFK assassination traditional annual show. 4 separate guests throughout the night, and of course your interactive phone calls. But we'll have Christopher Fulton on talking about the inheritance, poison fruit of JFK's assassination. Mark Shaw, the reporter who knew too much, in his work. Vince Palomara will be on to talk about JFK, and of course Paul DeBoole with his work as well. So lots of activity on our next Coast to Coast program. We're going to be back in a moment with our guest Mark Carlotto and take your phone calls. And welcome back to Coast. We're back with our final segment with Dr. Mark Carlotto, the author of Before Atlantis. Let's get to your calls right now. Let's go to Walter in Allentown, Pennsylvania to get us started. Hey, Walt.
Hi, George. Great conversation.
Thank you, sir.
George, I agree with Dr. Carlotto. I was perusing my old high school yearbook from the 60s, and it says that Neanderthals were undoubtedly already in the Alps region of Europe as early as 700,000 years ago. So, genomic study. George, when you had Dr. Don Simborg on, I recall well over a year ago, I guess it was, that I had made the statement that, George, in my opinion, you know, we have multiple species of hairy apes. We have the chimpanzees, the gorillas, the orangutans, and the gibbons. So as I remarked to Dr. Simborg that night, it's inconceivable that we would all be one species of naked ape. In other words, and I think that the recent research bears me out that, our human species is actually a hodgepodge of multiple subspecies and races. George, if you look at us, if you look at Europeans, if you can call that Homo caucasus, all right? Now, when you go from Southern Europe to Northern Europe, the skin gets lighter and lighter and lighter, and the hair gets lighter and lighter and lighter. You go from brown eyes to blue eyes, and this is simply natural selection. It's in response to the degree of sun. As you go north, naturally, the rays of the sun get weaker and weaker. And George, it was great research done by a doctor, Nina Jablonski. I believe she's at Stanford, and her associate is Dr. Spencer Wells. And they've done research where, our skin lightened in response to our body's need to assimilate vitamin D. In other words, because the melanin is the skin is a natural sunscreen. So, and if you look at in Africa, obviously you have multiple subspecies or races among, you want to call it Homo Africanus, the black people.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you go from in the plains, they're very tall. You have the Maasai, you have the Murli, the Watusi, but then if you go down in Sub-Sahara, down into the Congo regions, Uganda, you get the pygmies, and they're all very short. So obviously, we're a hodgepodge of different subspecies and races.
Well, there's no question about that. Mark, would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And referencing these different species, this expands now this timeline of this period of time. Over which humans were active on the planet, and it opens up all sorts of new possibilities. And so I think that's one tie-in with the research I'm doing, and I'm sure there's quite a few others. Of course, it also leads to the ultimate question: is what triggered these migrations out of Africa? It's sort of science sort of takes these as sort of axiomatic. They occurred. And since 70,000 years ago, humans have migrated, and there's been these genetic changes that we can track and exploit for your ancestry, that sort of thing that we talked about earlier. But the ultimate question is what triggered these, and I think genomics is a fascinating new direction.
Sure is.
That we can exploit.
We've got Mary in New Jersey now. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Oh, hello, Mr. Norrie. Hello to your guest. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
I'm thinking all the programs that I listen to. Ancient Romans, the ancient Greeks, could they have left us a clue? They talk about the planets. The Bible says that the sun and the moon were created day four. It took to day six to make animals and people. Now, these planets out there, could they be the Nephilim? Each one would be an estate of the Nephilim. And they traveled here before man and animals, and they built structures and whatever. They went back where they came from. Now, man is created, and they come back again. And they see the women, and they get in trouble. Is that possible?
Well, anything's possible, biblically speaking, of course. And again, as we talked about Eric von Däniken's theory, the thoughts of Zachariah Sitchin that ETs came here, genetically altered us. But Mark's theories are, of course, that humans and subhumans were here a long time ago and that they were part of this planet from the get-go. Mark, I'll let you elaborate on that.
Yeah, sure. You know, and perhaps these earlier species were the earlier versions of man, you know, that have been talked about in the ancient astronaut context. You know, maybe these were the result of evolution. Of course, then you could turn that around and say, well, what was the mechanism behind evolution? It's clearly not, you know, a random process. It's certainly not a gradual process like Darwin first suggested, but it's punctuated. Things happen very quickly, and then there's, you know, periods of little or no change. There's certainly, natural selection and changes within species, but there's been no known natural process that could be responsible for, say, the creation of a new species. And, we're talking about here in this context are, you know, three hominid species that have existed over the last million years, and how are they created? So, yeah, I mean, I'm not totally ruling out,
ET involvement.
ET involvement. Something happened. There was some outside agency. You can view that either as a creationist or from a religious context or from a scientific context, perhaps, in terms of, what's called intelligent design these days, or from an ET context as, intervention from outside somewhere. But then, of course, you know, that leads me to wonder, well, okay, if ETs were responsible for us, where did the ETs come from? You know, there had to have been some beginning somewhere. Maybe not. I mean, that's maybe just a limited way of looking at things. So this is why at the end of the day, I'm glad that I have geometry and images and maps that I can look at and say, yeah, this is an expression of the theory that I have here, because otherwise it gets into territory that's very speculative and it's hard to prove, and you're going to lose a lot of people that aren't open to this, to a scientific mindset, people that want evidence. I think if we can produce some hard evidence that at least begins to meet some of the criteria that they have. And I think, that's what I've tried to do in this book. I'm trying to bridge the gap between, sort of like what I did with Mars, is trying to bridge the gap between the speculative, sort of the fringe, the outside the box, and mainstream science. So, hopefully I'll begin to get a little bit of traction and these ideas.
I think it will.
But they're great. Yeah, thanks.
Andrew is with us, first-time caller in Exeter, Rhode Island. Andrew, go ahead, sir.
Hey, how are you doing? Thank you very much, George, and
sure,
always a pleasure to listen and rarely have had a chance. So, Mark, I live in Rhode Island, but from Western Massachusetts, and you must be outside the radius of the Boston accent up there in Cape Ann.
Well, I wasn't born here.
Oh. Look, I have a earth science and ocean science, marine geology, geochemistry, volcanology background. I got attracted more towards the instrumentation used in characterizing things on Earth, and outer space things that have been recently discovered, like pre-solar grains.
Yeah.
So mass spectrometers and stuff like that. The hardest thing for me to get my head around or grasp of all the things you've brought that have reasonable explanations, not requiring 100% speculation, but at the other end of the spectrum with scientific methodology, is this polar shift, and different than what we think about as the tilt of the Earth and the rotation axis. And the shift And I didn't really hear much about continental drift, except for what George mentioned about on the scale of 100 million years or something like that, which is, you know, plate tectonics. So you're correlating the alignment of these human-built structures with what we would speculate as they're trying to align with a pole, but not coming to the conclusion how really the poles shifted versus the usual occasional tilt of the axis, the rotation axis. So, regarding some of the anthropological discussions, I'm really happy to hear you talk about this one civilization that spread out, but a longer time ago, and that's really not so far-fetched to go back 100, 200,000 years, rather than think about on every continent you have people building pyramids in parallel with somehow being enlightened by perhaps something from space.
Right.
You know, but you're saying that there was migration longer ago than we normally think. So that's pretty cool. So, I don't know. It's just great stuff. And, of course, there are dating methods that can go back billions of years, like uranium lead.
All right. Let's get some comments from you. We're almost out of time here, Mark. But he's pretty poignant on a lot of issues.
Yeah. You know, let me talk a little bit about the pole shift. I'm not a geologist. I think it's a hard sell. I think it's easy to sell the idea of a massive pole shift at around the time of the Cambrian explosion. This is when the continents were much closer together. And there's plenty of paleomagnetic evidence to support it. What you have going back 100,000 years is I would say is inconclusive. The paleomagnetic data, for the most part, which uses radiometric dating, is only the uncertainty is about a half a million years. So if you're trying to localize the events in time over the last 100,000 years, it's not accurate enough. On the other hand, radiocarbon dating is very accurate, but it only goes to about 50,000 years ago. So you have a gap in there. But what I've been able to find is some paleomagnetic or archaeomagnetic evidence, which is radiocarbon dated magnetic samples that go out to 100,000 years that show an increase in the magnetic declination worldwide. And the speculation is that the paleopoles diverge over time. So as you go back further in time, they get farther and farther away from the current pole location. This could be an indication of more recent pole shifts, but it's not conclusive. But I'm not, you know, I'm not being an earth scientist, I can't argue mechanisms and theories, and I'm not going to try to do that because, you know, I want to stick to what I know. And so what I'm doing is I'm just bringing some new results and some evidence, and I'm struck by the fact that there's so many sites, there's over 50 sites that align to these four locations. If it's not a pole shift, then why do they align to these locations? And, you know, the most striking alignments are the ones in Peru's Sacred Valley, the oldest structures at Machu Picchu, Ollantaytambo, Cuzco, Sacsayhuaman, all point in the same direction. Why is that? Why was this direction so special? No one's offered an explanation for that. This is the only one that fits. So if someone can come up with a better explanation, I'm all ears.
Mark, your website, of course, beforeatlantis.com. The book is called Before Atlantis, of course. New evidence suggesting the existence of a previous technological civilization on Earth. And again, do you think there's any possibility that Martians fled here because something was happening to their planet? 30 seconds left, Mark.
Sure. I mean, ultimately everything's connected.
Yes.
And so if we can push the time horizon back further in time on Earth with this work, we get a little closer to maybe connecting it up with Mars.
I think so, too. Mark, thank you. Let's not be a stranger. And I want to just thank you for the years of work you've done. You've just been a remarkable person, my friend.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Mark Carlotto, he was on with us 20 years ago, and it's nice to have him back. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.